Good morning, and welcome to Sports Interview with Ann Liguori. How are we doing this morning? So glad you can join me where I am every week right here on WLIW 88.3 FM Southampton, serving Eastern Long Island and Southern Connecticut, 96.9 in Western Suffolk, and streaming at WLIW.org/radio and on your favorite streaming platforms. And each show is archived on my website at AnnLiguori.com and distributed on my podcast via Audioboom and iTunes. The summer is flying by, but we're managing to get it all in, some golf and a lot of fun times, and I hope you are too. I'm excited that my team won the member guest at Southampton Golf Club for the second straight year in the low gross category. You know, the club and the committee always do such a wonderful job with these tournaments. It was a party in paradise theme. Very creative, very clever. You know, Jimmy Buffett, Margaritaville, everything was so well thought out, and it's always a wonderful event. And we're actually going into the city to Madison Square Garden to see the Rush concert. They are performing all week. Their Rush 50-something tour is in full swing, and it has gotten amazing reviews. And I can't tell you how many of my friends and colleagues love this band. And a couple of them have told me that they're going to every show this week at the Garden and in surrounding areas. So it's they're diehard Rush fans. They haven't been on tour in years, obviously, since the drummer Neil Peart passed away. And they have a new drummer in, a woman from Germany who's supposed to be sensational. So I can't wait to hear them and to meet Alex Lifeson backstage. And in honor of Rush going back on tour, I am going to share an interview I did with Alex Lifeson, Hall of Fame guitarist and avid golfer. I had this conversation with him last summer, and it never gets old. So I hope you enjoy that. But first, award-winning journalist, author, and one of the most respected voices covering the LPGA for decades, Steve Eubanks joins us to preview the fifth and final major championship of the women's golf season, the AIG Women's Open, which is being held at Royal Lytham and St. Anne's in England. We'll also discuss his thought-provoking, excellent new book called God Ball, How Athletes Are Saving Christianity. There's always a lot of ground to cover with the great Steve Eubanks. So hope you enjoy this edition of Sports Interview. Steve Eubanks has long been one of the most respected voices in golf journalism. An award-winning author and veteran golf writer, he has covered the LPGA for decades and chronicled some of the game's greatest players and moments with insight, depth, and perspective. Beyond golf, Steve has explored the intersection of sports, culture, and faith in his latest book, God Ball, How Athletes Are Saving Christianity. Welcome back, Steve.
Well, it's nice to be with you, Ann. Thank you for having me again, as always.
Well, in this interview, I'd like to preview the AIG Women's Open at Royal Lytham and St. Anne's, get your thoughts on what restrictions, if any, the PGA Tour should impose on LIV players wishing to return to the PGA Tour. And of course, we'll talk about the inspiration behind your new book. So it's always wide open when I talk to Steve Eubanks, because you can basically talk about anything. And I love having you on talking golf. But let's start with the AIG Women's Open, which returns to Royal Lytham and St. Anne's in Lancashire, England. It is one of the world's most historic links courses, Steve, and they've hosted a lot of championships, including, what, six women's opens. I know Georgia Hall won in 2018, the last time Royal Lytham and St. Anne's hosted the women's open. What players do you think will do well there this week?
Well, look, obviously, if Nelly Korda putts well, she's going to be the odds-on favorite, and she's the odds-on favorite every time she tees it up if the putter is hot. So I think that golf course sets up so well for her, just because ball striking is at a premium and you have to pick some very precise spots. Unlike a lot of links courses where there's the luck of the bounce and you just have to be very, very fortunate to catch one side of a mound as opposed to another. Lytham is one of those golf courses where if you're precise in your iron play and disciplined in your distances, you can actually score very well. And Nelly's the best ball striker out there, so I don't think there's any doubt she has the edge.
Well, okay, so Nelly Korda, obviously she won the Chevron Championship earlier in the year, followed that open with her first US Open victory. If she were to win the Women's Open, Steve, where would that place this season amongst the greatest, do you think, in LPGA history?
There've been a lot of great seasons in LPGA history. I mean, you're going back to Annika Sorenstam and some of the great seasons that she had. But this has got to be right up there because the competition is so deep now. When you start looking at the number of players with multiple victories out on tour, and Nelly's what she's doing right now is going to be in the history books. I mean, if she wins, she will be in the LPGA Hall of Fame, which everybody recognizes as the most difficult hall to enter because it's points based and the number of points you have to have is pretty extraordinary given what you have to do. It will be the career Grand Slam for her, which would be something else that very few players have ever accomplished. So I think there, with all of the history on the line, obviously she's going to feel a lot of pressure. But if she's up to the task, this could be extraordinary for women's golf.
And let's explain to our listeners, Steve, that the women actually have five majors on the calendar. The men have four, but to win a career Grand Slam with the women's, it's only four, correct?
You got to win four of the five. Right.
Right.
And again, I don't know. That seems a little silly, perhaps, if you have five, but the fifth one was added recently, the Evian Championship. So historically, it's been four. And if you want to continue to have some continuity to the history involved, you want it to remain four.
Right. And but there has been one player to win five, right? Which they call the Super Career Grand Slam. Is that true? Kari Webb?
Corey Webb has won them all. That's correct. Yeah.
That's
Now, she
crazy.
when I say won them all, she won the old Du Maurier Championship in Canada back when that was also considered a major, and then it went away. So there weren't actually five majors at the time. There was simply a major that went off the schedule and another one came on. So yeah, she has won five.
So, going back to Nelly Korda, she missed the cut at the Evian, which was unusual. Everybody's, thinking, wow, she's won two majors. She's going to keep going here. Jenny Shin won the Women's Scottish Open, which I saw you were very thrilled about because it was her first victory in what, 10 years?
A little over 10 years, yeah.
Wow. So, Nelly Korda, she won the first two on the calendar. Heron Roux won the Evian Championship and the AIG Women's Open. Interesting that each captured two, are we going to see somebody else break the mold here?
Anybody, obviously, you don't want to say no because anybody can win. And that's the thing about this tour now is it is as deep as it's ever been. You may have a rookie come out of nowhere and be able to pull something off. But links golf is so different. You have to be able to control your trajectory. You've got to be patient in the wind. You've got to understand some of the lies and the bounces that you're going to get. You've got to be able to play for the rollout. It's just not something that you walk up and master your first time out. Nelly has grown to love it. It took a while for her to get there, but I think now that she is there, I really have to put her at the top of the list.
Is she comfortable being the face of the LPGA tour, do you think?
Now she is. She wasn't for a while. She came out as a teenager. Her rookie year, she was 19 years old. And if you think of all of the mistakes you made at 19 and 20, I mean, I know that I couldn't have been the face of anything at that point in my life. But she was very, very determined to be the best player in the world. Once she got there, she realized that the spotlight and the pressure was a lot. And I don't think initially she was comfortable with that. She has now grown into that role. Her press conferences, where before they weren't very good, they're outstanding now. Very rarely does she not go speak to the media. And when she does, choose to pass, there's usually a good reason for it. So she's been much more comfortable now in her presence, in making herself available, in some of the sponsorship obligations that she has. None of those things came naturally to her, but she's grown into that role.
Steve, I know you've seen a lot of commissioners having been with the LPGA so
Yes.
many decades, and Craig Kesler has now had time to put his stamp on the LPGA. What do you think's been the biggest difference you've noticed under his leadership?
Focus on television. He wants to make sure that all of the television rounds are live, and that we're getting the amount of coverage that the ladies deserve. And look, it's always been a challenge. You're going tape delayed with an event, and by the, in the age of Twitter, everybody knows who's won by then. So that it's almost like watching a rerun of a sitcom. The jokes don't hit the same. So it's him getting every single round broadcast live, whether it's on Golf Channel or in last week it was CNBC. There's always some place that you can find live women's golf when they're playing, and that to me has been, if I had to give him a grade in that category, it would be an A for his first year for sure.
Yeah, it's only his first year, so he has a lot more time to make his mark. But you're right, we're seeing a lot more prime time coverage of the
Sure.
LPGA, which is so important. So the LPGA has extraordinary talent. We all know that. But why hasn't that translated, Steve, into greater mainstream popularity, do you think?
I think you hit on it just a second ago. You can't go through as many commissioners as they have had and have the change in leadership over and over, new direction, new philosophies, and have any sort of continuity. The continuity of message, in my view, needs to be, we have to tell the personalities of the players. We've got to get people, when you just see that leaderboard and you don't recognize any names, you've got to know, you need to know something about those players, particularly considering that it is such a global tour with players from so many countries that you may not know. I mean, you may not know any of them. The story that I love to tell is of Ingjie Chun, who has been a three-time major champion and is considered one of the top players in the world. Well, most people they just say, Ingjie Chun, I guess she's from Korea. I don't know anything about her. One of the most fascinating people you'll ever meet in the sport, she's a math genius. She actually taught herself advanced mathematics. She's an autodidact. And she ended up having to support her family in Korea when their business had troubles, wins the Koreans Women's Open and the US Women's Open immediately after that. It's one of the most inspirational stories in sports, and yet very, very few people know it because they just see her name and they move along.
That's right. I mean, I just
Telling those
think
stories, that's the
telling those
key.
stories, exactly. Getting
Right.
those stories out on prime time is very important, as well as the live coverage. You got to tell the story so people feel that connection.
Absolutely. And you can't just tell it once. That's what I keep reminding everyone. Okay, when I say, the Cordas are probably the most athletic family in history, the answer I get is, well, everybody knows that. No, they don't. You and I know it because we're in the game. Everybody doesn't know it. And you have to repeat that story over and over and over so that everybody does know it and they start paying attention and they have a rooting interest.
Plus, Steve, I think we need more crossover stars. Players who have the potential to become crossover stars beyond golf. Now, Nelly Korda has that potential, and perhaps she's already crossed over. What's your opinion on that? Is she a crossover star at this point, Nelly Korda?
She's getting there. And again, I think she recognizes it. She recognizes the potential to be that crossover star. The only woman that I would say right now has achieved that is not the best player in the WNBA. It's Sophie Cunningham. And she has done that by going out and building her brand away from basketball and by doing other things. And just the weight of her personality has driven her there. We need that sort of thing in golf. We do have it. I mean, Nelly is one. Charlie Hull is another. Charlie is certainly someone who could go out and through the force of nature that she is and her personality could break out of golf and go into the mainstream.
And I think in order to do that, you have to take positions on issues like Sophie Cunningham has. Maybe she doesn't want to be a recognized activist, but she has spoken out against a lot of different issues in sport. And it's become a mainstream, she's become a guest on a lot of mainstream shows because of it. So I don't know if we're going to see that with some of the golf stars, but that's almost what you have to do to kind of cross over. Do you think Caitlin Clark, she's not really political at all, but she's been able to take her sport, she's taken it to the next level. And a lot of times the golfers would ask me, the LPGA players would say, why can't our sport be as popular as women's basketball? How do you answer that question?
Well, it should be, and it can be. One of the things that Caitlin broke out because she played a different style of basketball. It was almost like watching a video game. I mean, when you watched Caitlin on the basketball court, it was like the heady days when Steph Curry was throwing up shots from half court. You were watching it saying, this can't be real. So it really transformed the way women's basketball was being played. And there was an opportunity in the WNBA to capitalize on that and take advantage of it and parlay it to their advantage. Now, I personally believe they've blown that through some of the idiocy that they put out there. And that's one of the reasons that Sophie Cunningham has risen, I think, in popularity. She stood up to the bullies. She hasn't gone along with the party line. She has been the person who has stood out and said, these are the things I'm going to do, and these are the things that I believe. And I'm not going to waver from that. And that's so rare now in sport where everybody is attempting to say the right thing and do the right thing and be amenable in every circumstance. And here's a girl who has proven that no, go be yourself, stand up for what you believe, protect your teammates, do what's right, stand up to bullies, and you will become the most popular athlete in your sport. Now, I
And good
think,
for her because I know she's spoken out against transgender athletes competing with women, which is great. I mean, it's not the politically correct thing to say, but it's just so obvious to me that, a guy that has an operation to become a woman should not be competing with women in sports.
well, that's an 80-20 issue, and I think it's more like a 95-5 issue. I think 15% of the 20 are lying to you. So it's to make that sort of statement is kind of saying the obvious. But the fact that no one in no active player has been willing to stand up and do that is a testament to her courage, really. But it's also a testament to some of the pressure that is put upon people. By their sponsors and by their leagues. Again, I think that's why Sophie has become so popular because she stood up to that.
Right. Good. Very good points. All right. Let's turn our attention to the PGA Tour and LIV Golf. Do you think, Steve Eubanks, that the PGA Tour should welcome back the players who bolted for LIV? Now that LIV looks like quickly going out of business, do you feel that the PGA Tour should welcome some of these top players back?
Well, let's think the matter through. Who would it be? With the exception of Bryson DeChambeau, whom should they welcome back that's going to have any sort of impact right now, that's going to move the needle at all on the PGA Tour? Now, I actually think there's a better argument to be made that the PGA Tour champions definitely needs to invite those guys back. Because when you start talking about Henrik Stenson and Ian Poulter and Graham McDowell, that group that would be playing on the PGA Tour champions now is that could actually move that needle. And that's a tour that desperately needs it. The PGA Tour right now, I think, is got the entire upper hand because they're in the position. You need us a lot more than we need you. Again, with the exception of Bryson, who's kind of an animal unto himself, there really isn't a motivation for them to come to those terms. Now, they may do it. They may end up saying, here are the guidelines with which you need to operate in order to come back. And I think they probably will come to something like that. But right now, if you're Brian Rolapp, you've got to be saying, for what purpose, would I bring all these guys back onto the tour?
Right. Of course, you have Jon Rahm, people like Cameron Smith. I mean, there's so many players who just basically went to live, with the exception of Jon Rahm, who's done decent in some of the majors this year, who just you've kind of lost touch with them and have not seen them play, and they've basically fell off the planet seemingly. So, I mean, there are a
Since
lot
Cam
of
Smith won at St. Andrews, I don't know that I've seen him hit a golf shot. I mean, think about it. I mean, where would you have seen him? Now, I say that the Anthony Kim winning in Australia may be the the best story in golf for the year. So that's one exception. But that's the only thing I can think of on LIV that has actually moved the needle. So maybe you give these guys a pathway through the DP World Tour, or give them a pathway through some of the late fall events, something. But just to welcome them back, no, I don't think that's ever going to happen.
Right. I do believe they should welcome them back with restrictions. Obviously, they left a tour that gave them a lot, a platform, and gave them a great career. And, it's loyalty versus greed, in my opinion. They took the money and ran. But yes, it would be great to have some of these players back, but not without restrictions. So hopefully, and it's particularly Bryson DeChambeau. I actually like Bryson DeChambeau. I'd love to see him come back. I think. Obviously he's so popular, he has a huge social media presence. And I do feel if he could put his ego aside and if the PGA Tour could figure out a way to welcome him back, with the same restrictions perhaps that they gave Brooks Koepka, I would love to see these guys back playing on the PGA Tour. I just think it would be more interesting. So, but you're right.
Well,
You're
it
in a
would
position.
be. Now, Bryson is a different example. The PGA Tour, when you sign up for membership, they own your media rights. So all of those things that Bryson is doing on his own YouTube channel, the Break 50 and all of that goes away if he rejoins the PGA Tour. And to me, while the majority of the players took the money, Bryson did it because he wanted to control his brand. And so there's going to be that kind of a rub with him. Where is he going to play, and how is he going to play in a manner that he can still own his media rights? And I just think that's something that the tour is going to have to grapple with, not just with him, but with other players. I mean, Rory is making noises now about perhaps not playing a full schedule. So, you have to ask yourself, is he doing that for the money? Well, of course not. He's doing it because he wants to play. He wants to A, set his own schedule, but B, then he controls his own media rights. And I had this conversation with Tim Fincham in the early 2000s about Tiger. I said, if Tiger Woods wanted to come to you and say, you know what, I'm going to play the majors and at the time the World Golf Championships events, two or three others where I'm a past champion, and that's my schedule. And now I own my own media rights. Why wouldn't he do that? Now, Tiger didn't because he felt a loyalty to the tour, but there are some guys now who I think are probably having those same questions.
Absolutely. The PGA Tour, I thought, put out a statement soon after Bryson DeChambeau made the statement about his social media and how he'd need to have more freedom with it, where they would allow some of what Bryson's doing during practice rounds, but not during tournament rounds. So, yeah, I'm sure there's still a lot that the PGA Tour would have to iron out when it comes to rights like that. All right. So I'm holding your latest book, God Ball, How Athletes Are Saving Christianity. Boy, it's a great topic, and good for you, Steve Eubanks, for kind of bringing it out there, because they're talking more about their faith, and it seems to be more the norm now than not. And I think people of faith do a great job balancing success with their humility and faith. So their faith teaches them how to deal with all kinds of pressures and all kinds of situations.
It grounds you in everything in life. It grounds you in everything. And as a result of that, I mean, people can sense it in you. If you're a deep abiding person of faith and you're around someone for an hour, you know it, whether or not the subject ever comes up. And I think that's what people are looking for in their role models and athletes now.
Do you find, Steve, that there perhaps are a higher percentage of people with faith in the golf industry or not?
I would have said yes 10 years ago, But now that I have gone out and looked in all of the other sports, I'm not so sure. I think that it's really across the board. I mean, the number of college football players that I have talked to, that have a deep-seated faith, not and that are very outspoken about it. They're running on-campus revivals now. There are players at Ohio State are conducting baptisms. So it's a big thing at every level, but I think that now we had seen it previously in golf because there was really nobody out there saying, "Hey, don't do this." There was no team manager or no team owner kind of setting the terms of what could and could not be said. So players felt comfortable doing it. Well, now you're seeing it everywhere. Players are saying, "I don't care what you say. I'm going to go out and speak about what's important here."
And explain the ramifications, if you would, Steve, of Kennedy versus Bremington. Joseph Kennedy, assistant football coach, Bremington High School in Washington State, I believe.
Yes.
You would kneel at the 50-yard line after games to pray. The school district put him on leave. He sued them. The Supreme Court ruled in his favor. So, are we seeing ramifications out there because of this judgment?
Absolutely. Look, here was a volunteer football coach. I mean, the guy wasn't even on staff at the school. He was a welder. Because of his Marine Corps background, the coaches had asked him to come in and help build kind of a team environment. And very happily had done so, but would go to midfield by himself after every game and say a silent prayer. Players started joining him. Players from both teams started coming out and joining him. And of course, that led to a lawsuit. The administration told him he had to stop. He said, "I'm not going to stop." So they fired him as a coach. That took over 10 years for that to work its way through the court system all the way up to the Supreme Court. And if you want to talk about divine intervention, this happened, the decision came down shortly after the COVID pandemic. Look, if it had hit in 2019, we would have said, "Oh, gee, yeah, well, that's an interesting decision." But then the pandemic would have kind of wiped it off the map. The fact that the pandemic came and then the decision came, people were saying, "There's a message here." And the message is, we have to stand up. We have to stand up no matter the people that are telling us not to, and we've got to go out and speak our minds.
Well, I'm sure God Ball, How Athletes Are Saving Christianity, took an extraordinary amount of research. Tell me what surprised you the most in your research and in your writings in the book.
The volume of athletes who were willing to talk about this. I mean, look, you and I have been in the business long enough to know that when you speak to an athlete, you have to get through the cliches before you can actually get to something, because they understand what the soundbite is going to be. And so you ask a question and they've got this pre-programmed answer that comes back. Well, I was so concerned that I was going to get a lot of that as I was talking to these people. Couldn't have been further from the truth. Not only did they want to talk about it, I couldn't get some of them to shut up. I mean, I remember reaching out to Kirk Cousins, the NFL quarterback, and just saying, "Hey, could you just give me 20 minutes?" Well, hour and a half later, I was like, "Kirk, you need to go. I mean, I've kind of got what I need here." But he was tremendous. And that was across the board. Everyone that I reached out to couldn't wait to talk about this, and they gave me everything I needed. So that was really the biggest surprise.
Dusty Baker, Dabo Swinney, Kirk Cousins, Riley Gaines, Sage Steele. I mean, you got some pretty heavy-duty interviews here with a variety of athletes and broadcasters.
Yeah, it was a really great process. And again, I was so pleasantly surprised by how many people would be receptive to reach out and talk about the faith. And again, in such an open and honest fashion, you again expect some to be guarded, but they weren't. They were talking about it as openly as anything that I've ever seen.
Are people of faith now the most popular people in the room, would you say?
Oh yeah, I don't think it's close. And again, I think that in the olden days, you knew who the leaders were, and in the back of your mind, you knew, these people seem very Christian to me. Now it's just out in the open. And I think there is a lot of people who say, whatever he has, that's what I want. And so that's what's leading others to it.
Always a pleasure, Steve Eubanks. The book is called God Ball: How Athletes Are Saving Christianity. I love your insight. I love your writings, and I love talking to you about all kinds of issues in golf. So thanks again for joining us.
Thanks, Anne. It's always great to be with you.
The legendary Alex Lifeson, Hall of Fame guitarist for the band Rush, and so many other things that we hopefully will talk about. Hey, Alex.
Hi, Anne. It's great to see you again. It's been a couple of years, I think.
I know. It has been a couple of years. What have you been up to since we honored you at our charity golf event in the Hamptons a couple of years ago?
Yeah.
It's so great to reconnect with you.
I think when I saw you, we were just releasing an album for Envy of None, the first album. Which went well. The experience was great. It was just a recording project for musicians getting together and making a record. It took us about a year to make that record, but it was a really satisfying experience working with, you know, different artists, particularly Maya Wynn, the singer, who was just absolutely amazing. We started the second record soon after the release of the first one, and we spent a little over a year working on that record too, which was released in March, and that's called Stygian Waves. That's the second record, and I think we really kind of developed into more of a band with that record. It wasn't so much just this project. There's just a unity in the material, the way the songs were developed. There's great variety. Each song is really quite different from the other, and I think the underlying connection is Maya's voice, which is absolutely spectacular, and her lyrics are wonderful. So for me, you know, coming at the end of the Rush experience in 2015, it was nice to get into something that I could really sink my teeth into and really do what I know how to do, rather than just sitting around trying to play golf, which I don't know how to do. I'm learning as I get older. But so that was really, really a great experience doing that. And I've been working on another project with a group of musicians for a documentary about the Great Lakes, and a very interesting kind of concept. And it was all jam based, and we had hours and hours and hours of material that we went through, and we've created some really beautiful sounding instrumental music on its way to, you know, becoming an album. Hopefully by the early fall that'll be done, and we're looking at possibly doing a couple of dates as well. Just very, again, very spontaneous, improvisational kind of music, but it's just another dimension, you know. I feel like I've been reborn with all the music projects that I'm doing now, because it was really kind of quiet for me, and I was trying to find my way. And what am I going to do? Am I just going to be a part-time golfer for the rest of my years, or what? And this has thrust me right back into it, and I'm working on all these projects, and I'm playing a little less golf, and I don't know. I don't think that's such a bad thing. I mean, I'm still playing a couple times a week on average, so that's not too bad. But I could use a break. Golf's hard.
Golf is very, very hard, for sure. The last time you were on my show, Alex, on Talking Golf, Neil Peart had just passed. It was probably a couple months after that happened. And you were very sad, obviously. He was like a brother to you, and very open on the show, and said you just didn't have it in you to pick up the guitar.
Yeah, that's true. It's, you know, when Neil's daughter died in a car accident in 97, it was the same thing. You know, we shut it down, and I just had no interest in a lot of things, especially something like music, which is such a passionate, spiritual thing. When he passed 5 years ago, 5.5 years ago, it was the same thing. It really had no drive to play for about a year. And then I came out of it, and I find grieving, I've had so much experience at grieving now in my adult life, that I kind of have it sort of figured out. For me, I commit to a year of grief, and then it's time to move on. And you can still pay tribute to the person that you've lost, the memory. It's fewer tears and more smiles, I think, what happens after a period. And certainly that's the way. You know, we're always looking at some sort of tribute to Neil in our daily lives, Getty and I both. We, you know, Getty and I get together a lot. You know, we're really, really close friends. And we have not lost an iota of love for our lost brother. And we celebrate him as much as we can.
It must have felt so good to get back in the studio and to play, as you say, for that envy of none and even jamming with Getty.
Oh, absolutely. Like I said, I mean, that's what I've grown up with. You know, we, Ged and I have been friends since we were 13. We were started the band when we were 15 years old, and that's been our whole life work. Neil was kind of done, you know, at the end of the tour. It's understandable. His job was way harder than ours. He played at 110%, like every gig. And he got to a point in his early 60s where physically playing a three-hour show at that intensity was becoming too difficult, and he would not accept 99.9%. It had to be 100 or 110 in his case. So that was understandable, but it was difficult for us, for Getty and I, to kind of accept that was it. We still had lots of gas in the tank. And I'm sure we talked about this way back then. But so we've always kind of lived with that for the last 10 years. So for me to get back into the studio, I just feel I'm where I belong. And it's a rebirth for me in a lot of ways. I just feel so excited with playing. And I'm playing a lot. And it feels good. My fingers feel good. I missed it. I missed that feeling. So I'm loving it.
Do you think you'll go out on tour at all? Do you think about it?
Oh, yeah, we think about all that stuff, but, you know, who knows? I've got my hands full with so many things right now, so I don't know about that in particular, but, you know, you never know where life is going to take you. That's what I've come to realize. Like, every day is a different day, and opportunities come and go, and you take some and you skip on some, and you just see whatever kind of fits, feels right at the time. So right now I got a whole bunch of right stuff, so I'm pretty happy with that.
And so how much golf can you play?
So, you know, I was typically playing three or four times a week. And, you know, a couple of years ago, I was usually five. You know, when we had our place in the country, I was playing 5 days a week, easily 5 days a week. I'm playing probably on average, two or three days. I mean, this month is pretty filled up with golf. Last month, hardly any at all. And August is starting to fill up. So I'm sure I'll get to my, you know, three-round, four-round quota. But, you know, as we were talking many times, golf is such a very, very difficult sport. There's so many things that are counterintuitive about it, so much stuff to remember. So much of it is getting out of the way of it, and so much of it is you absolutely can't help yourself to get in the way of it. You know, I was saying to you, on the range, I'm easily a 2-3 handicap on the range. I can pick targets. I can hit to those targets. I don't have, you know, I'm 71. I don't have the same length that I had. But I get on the first tee, and I'm a basket case, like over and over and over without fail. It's such an infuriating game.
Can you bring anything from music to golf?
Well, you know, the tempo is, I hear this from everybody I play with. Oh, you're a musician. You know everything about tempo. Why don't you have great tempo? And I think about that all the time, and I'm not quite sure what great tempo is. I get the concept of what it is, and often, you know, my swing, I'm told, you have beautiful tempo. It's nice and smooth and easy. I'm swinging as hard as I can. Like, I'm not even thinking about tempo, but I understand it. And if you want to get your hips to move, if you want to get your shoulders to turn, you have to have the right tempo. If it's too fast, things are out of sequence. The hands are too quick. Casting, major problem for me. But I don't know where that spot is between too slow and smooth. You know, the difference between fast and hard. Because you want to hit the golf ball hard, but you don't want to be too fast. It is an unbelievable game.
It keeps you out there, right? The challenge keeps you going.
I know. And that's the other thing. How many times have you come down 18 and you have the best hole of the round on 18? Because they know. They want to get you back out on the golf course soon.
Favorite golf memory, what would you say?
Geez, I've had so many. You know, I've played with Rocco Mediate so many times. I had him up to Copperwood, the club that I was a member at. He was there for four of our member guests, and it was just awesome. He's such a personable guy. Everybody absolutely adored him, and he made himself available to everybody like he always does. He's a remarkable guy. I've had some great rounds with Lee Jansen and Mark Calcavecchia. I heard from Mark the other day. We stay in touch. We keep threatening to get together sometime soon, and I would like to do that. So, like, you know, I have those memories from that other generation of golfers. I had Dave Hempstead. He's a local comedian here. I brought him down to your tournament a couple of years ago, and I played with Dave a lot. And he's a really good golfer. You've seen him play, and but he's also so funny. So I don't know. Some holes I'm crying so hard from laughing that I can't even swing the club. So every game is a memorable game except for the ones that aren't. You know what I mean?
I love that quote. Can we use that one?
Sure.
Well, I know you golf in Ireland and probably Scotland. And do you like links golf?
Yeah, I love it, especially over there where it's the true links. You know, you have that experience here and there on this side of the ocean. Some courses that make themselves like that and some that are naturally like that. But over there, there's a plethora of those sort of linksy courses, and they all have very individual characters. We were talking about the Island course just outside of Dublin. Wow, is that is truly links, like right to the core. And it's just such a visually enchanting setting to be playing in Royal County Down. We played there on a very gray, misty day, and it was magical. Honestly, magical. There was fog in up on the mountain, and the green and the course was so green and purple, and the heather, and it was just stunning. And that's what golf provides for you, just this incredible environment to chase that little ball around. Yeah.
It really does. The scenic beauty of the golf courses. One's more beautiful than the next. Now, you and I met a number of years ago at Robbie Krieger's celebrity tournament. So I'm going to ask you if you could put together a foursome of, say, some of your closest musician friends, who would it be?
Oh, okay. So I have to think about that one. I played with Alice a lot, and Alice is great. It's a great golf partner. He's a very fascinating guy. He has great stories. And he's quite talented as a golfer. You know how important golf is to him, to his whole life. I'd probably get Alice in there. And Robbie's a king. I love Robbie so much. He's we've become really, really good friends. I never expected that to happen. You know, you meet people and you have a nice time together and you sort of move on, but we've stayed in touch. I go out and I play at his events whenever I can. It's, you know, always for a good cause, for St. Jude's, among other things. And And then we jam, and he gets me to jam with other people. He took me out the last time I was there. We went out a couple of nights, just on off nights, and he took me to clubs where people were playing, and we got up on stage and jammed with them. I mean, I don't really do stuff like that so much, but he kind of forced me into doing it, and I loved it. And we play together, and I'm looking at him, you know, I grew up with the Doors, so I'm looking at the guitar player of the Doors, and I'm like, oh, this is awesome, standing beside the guitar player of the Doors. We're playing guitar together. So that's a magical thing. So he would definitely be the third. And then the fourth, Tom Cochran. Tom Cochran is a Canadian artist. Life is a Highway. It was his big... Well, one of his big hits, but probably the biggest one that your audience would recognize. Tom and I play a lot. We do a trip to Arizona every February. We play Whisper Rock and Estancia and Silver Leaf. We're there for a week together. We get together here locally and play a little bit over the summer. But he's a great golfer and also a great storyteller. So that would be a really awesome foursome.
That would be a fabulous foursome. Can I tag along? Can I caddy?
Of course.
Now, you're a golfer in addition to obviously one of the top guitarists in the world, a producer, a pilot, a painter. How would you rank these activities, would you say, in terms of passion?
Well, I think I'm passionate about all of them when I do them. I was doing paintings annually for the Kidney Foundation here in Canada. And they had a program where they got celebrities to do paintings. And it started out as a very basic thing. They send you a small little, not a canvas, really a board, and a little platelet of color paints, of acrylic paints. And you know, a couple of brushes. So the first year I did that, and I thought, screw this. I went out and I spent thousands of dollars buying paints, and I got every shade of every color. I got the best brush. Like, I really did a number. I got proper canvases, and I started taking it much more seriously. Every time I do it, and I spend, you know, 4 to 6 weeks on a piece, every time I do it, I just feel so gratified that I did it. And I don't know why I don't do it more regularly. Like, life gets in the way of some things, and painting for me is one of the things. I would do a lot more of it, and I hope to eventually. Flying, I don't do very much flying anymore. I always believe that you have to be proficient in flying. You can't just be a fair weather flyer if you're going to be serious about it. It's very easy to kill yourself in an airplane. I was gung-ho for probably the first few decades after I got my license in 1980. And I flew, and on the road, I used to take crew guys flying. But because I traveled so much, I never bothered getting an airplane. So I didn't make that commitment in that way. So I enjoyed the whole flying experience, the whole pilot experience, but I guess I'm just not quite so passionate about that anymore.
So guitarist, golfer, painting, would that be the order?
I would say so, yeah, yeah.
See, I know you, Alex Lifeson. All right, so talk about getting into the ale business. I love those social media spots I'm seeing. There's one that's a non-alcoholic beer that you and Getty did this little spot on. It's called Your Turn to Drive. That was hysterical.
So the brewery is Henderson Brewery. They're here in Toronto. They're a boutique brewery, and they make a lot of products, and they're all really good. The quality is so excellent, and they're wonderful to work with. A few years ago, it was during COVID, there was the thought about maybe having our own beer. And so we got together. Ged and I sampled about 25 beers, I think. Porters, ales, lagers, the whole gamut. And we settled on three. And of those three, the final one was the Canadian ale. It's delicious. It's done really, really well. But the fun thing is we decided to do these ads for our beer products. And they're like off the cuff, We don't rehearse them. We don't write them out. We just do a bunch of scenes and we goof around and joke around. And they've become so popular. I mean, it's really, it's like a new age in advertising that we've sort of latched onto. But the one that we did recently for the non-alcoholic beer is a particularly funny one. Yeah, they're all really, really kind of funny and fun.
And they're not, they're just off the cuff, right? You just make it up as you go.
Yeah, we pick a date. We go to the brewery and, there's a couple of cameras and some lights. And what are we doing? Okay, this is for this. Okay, let's do that. And then we just throw out a bunch of ideas and there's a little bit of editing involved, but there's really a lot of fun to do.
And you have a mustard too, the Rush Golden Ale Mustard.
Oh yeah, the mustard, the Sluska, the mustard is fantastic. It's made with our beer. It's really, really delicious.
I can't wait to try that too. I'm seeing all this stuff you've done. Okay, final two questions. Of all the songs you wrote or co-wrote, Alex, I know it's like picking your favorite kid, which is impossible. What one would you say is most meaningful to you?
It is like picking a child. But I would say if I had to pick one song, it would be the last song on the last record, which was The Garden. And it's a very poignant song. I think that song really meant a lot to Neil, and it was ironic that he became ill, and a lot of the things that he touched on in the garden were very connected to his illness and his death. So that one always sticks with both of us deep down.
I mean, Working Man, Anthem, In the Mood, The Spirit of Radio. There's just so many.
Yeah, there's lots of them.
What is out there that you yet have to do? That anything in your mind that you just haven't tried yet that you just have to do?
I don't know if I feel like I'm lacking anything in my life. I have a fantastic family. My grandkids are grown up now, and one's in college, and the other one's got his own business, and I just celebrated my 50th anniversary a few months ago. I'm playing guitar for 3 hours a day. There's a good balance in my life. I don't feel like I'm missing anything. I think my bucket's pretty empty, I have to admit. And it's a good feeling because I feel energized and I feel like there's so much ahead of me. And some of it is the same old stuff, and some of it's a little different, but it's the activity that counts. It's the propulsion, the movement forward that life is all about.
Any holes in ones?
I have one hole in one. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Then you've done it all.
I have done it all.
Alex Lifeson, thank you so much. What a pleasure to reconnect. Really enjoyed our time together.
Yeah. I love seeing you, Anne. It's great to see you.
Thank you. Hope you enjoyed this edition of Sports Interview. My thanks to Alex Lifeson, to Steve Eubanks, and to Mike Goodsell in production. Remember, sports can reveal greatness, but faith reveals purpose. Have a great week, and I look forward to visiting with you next time right here on Sports Interview with Anne Liguori.